Jeff. So I have a question for you. Who here likes comics? Anyone? No? Okay, phew, there's a couple of you. None of you like comics. That's shocking to me. One of my favorite comics as a child was Calvin and Hobbes. This is a story of a mischievous boy and a stuffed tiger who, in the boy's imagination, was very much alive. The comic was more than just funny, this comic strip in particular. I think it was actually quite profound, filled with these insights about childhood, adventure, and the absurdities of adult life, some of which at that age I definitely did not get, and still probably don't. And that's okay. But the creator of this Sunday comic strip, Bill Watterson, the man on your left, he became one of the most famous cartoonists of his generation. And by the late 1980s, Calvin and Hobbes had reached tens of millions of readers, becoming one of the most beloved comic strips of all time. Then, at the peak of his success, Watterson did something quite shocking. He chose to walk away from it all. He had publishers and toy companies begging him to commercialize his work with plush toys, animated shows and films, coffee mugs. Had he agreed, he would have made hundreds of millions of dollars for sure. But Watterson refused. He saw the relentless drive for more. More money, more fame, more control. More as something that threatened the purity of the art. So in 1995, with Calvin and Hobbes at its height, he ended the strip. He left behind the wealth, the notoriety, stepping into a quiet, private life where he was painting and spending time with his family. Unlike artists who often attempt comebacks, Watterson never really returned to the industry. In a rare interview years later, he explained this decision, or his decision in particular. He said this: "I had everything I could possibly want, but the pressure to keep feeding the machine, to keep producing, to keep chasing more, it was exhausting. And I realized I didn't want to spend my life doing that." His words hit home, don't they? That pressure to keep feeding the machine, to keep things going, to build for something more in the future that's better. It's not just celebrities who feel it, right? Because I hope that we all might feel that in some way, shape, or form. I know I do. And yet society constantly berates us and tells us that we need it. We need more money. We need more success. We need more recognition. I mean, how many of us feel like all this striving is actually leading to more happiness? How many of us feel like it's exhausting? What if it's actually leading us away from it, from that joy, away from the true joy, the contentment, or even our truest selves? Well, today we are continuing our series on this upside-down kingdom, where we explore key moments when Jesus challenged social norms and expectations, where he offers us a counterintuitive perspective on what it means to be truly blessed. And today's passage specifically presents one of these moments where Jesus turns some conventional wisdom on its head, inviting us to maybe reconsider what our world might be and what our world might declare as a blessing. And so let me read our passage for us from Luke 6, 20 to 26, and you can see it on the screen. So starting at verse 20, looking at his disciples, he, Jesus, said this: "Blessed are you who are poor, for yours is the kingdom of God. Blessed are you who hunger now, for you will be satisfied. Blessed are you who weep now, for you will laugh. Blessed are you when people hate you, when they exclude you and insult you and reject your name as evil because of the Son of Man. Rejoice in that day and leap for joy, because great is your reward in heaven. For that is how their ancestors treated the prophets. But woe to you who are rich, for you have already received your comfort. Woe to you who are well fed now, for you will go hungry. Woe to you who laugh now, for you will mourn and weep. Woe to you when everyone speaks well of you, for that is how their ancestors treated the false prophets. When you think maybe about our world today, that just doesn't sound right, does it? Blessed are the poor, blessed are the hungry, blessed are those who weep. And then we have these more unsettling words of woe to the rich, woe to the well-fed, woe to those who laugh, which I will say is the most challenging one for me. But I do think that this passage actually helps us reflect on what the true meaning of success or fulfillment might be. And it forces us to ask some important questions like, what does it really mean to be blessed? What are we filling ourselves with? What are we chasing? Well, in order to understand this context a little bit better, I have some information for us that might help. Often, this passage is compared to Matthew's Sermon on the Mount, but this passage here is actually referred to as the Sermon on the Plain, on a level place, which describes the scene where Jesus, instead of standing above everyone else on this mountain, is actually standing on level ground with them, which in and of itself might not be that abnormal. And yet, here he is addressing this large crowd of his disciples and a multitude of people from various regions, including Judea, Jerusalem, coastal areas like Tyre and Sidon. These individuals had come to hear him to be healed of their diseases. Those who were troubled by impure spirits were cured, and the crowd sought to touch him, recognizing the power that was emanating from him. In this diverse assembly, Jesus delivers this series of blessings and woes that challenge prevailing cultural norms. He declares the poor, the hungry, those who weep, and the persecuted as blessed, while pronouncing woe upon the rich, the well-fed, those who laugh, and those who are well spoken of. In Jesus' time, wealth, abundance, joy, a good reputation, these were commonly viewed as signs of God's favor and blessing because of the prevailing interpretation of the Hebrew scriptures and the honor-shame culture that shaped the Jewish society. In the Old Testament, it frequently associated obedience to God's commandments with material prosperity, long life, and national security. Passages like Deuteronomy 28, 1 to 14, or Psalm 112, 1 to 3, these reinforce the belief that those who are righteous would be rewarded with tangible blessings, while those who suffered must have been experiencing divine judgment. Additionally, the Jewish and Greco-Roman worlds are deeply hierarchical. The social status as a visible indicator of one's honor or disgrace. Those who were wealthy and well-regarded were assumed to be in God's favor. And conversely, poverty, hunger, sorrow, persecution were often marginalized and viewed with suspicion, indicating some form of divine disfavor or personal failure. This perspective was particularly evident among the Pharisees, who compared outward success with deep religious devotion and righteousness. And so we find ourselves here in this moment on the plain with hordes of people trying to touch him, trying to receive some sort of healing. And then Jesus does his thing. He disrupts everything as he flips the script, reorienting us to something different. Far different than we could have expected. Something I think we still deal with today. I mean, this doesn't sound too different from our current state, right? I think, quite unfortunately, similar cultural norms still exist and persist. Society often equating success with material wealth, physical comfort, happiness, social approval. I mean, even social media platforms like Instagram amplify this perception to a ridiculous level, presenting these curated images of this blessed life, of vacations in beautiful places, of promotions, of prosperity, of joy, so much so that it has most of us likely questioning our own blessedness. We get jealous. We see what someone else has, and we long for it. And then we feel like we just need more, because more is better. In a world that constantly tells us that having more means living better, Jesus turns that assumption on its head. We spend our lives striving for more money, more security, more recognition, believing that fullness comes from accumulation. But what if the opposite is actually true? What if emptiness is actually the doorway to true blessing? Jesus begins his sermon not with praise for the wealthy, the powerful, and the well-fed, but for those who have nothing left to cling on to but God. He redefines what it means to be truly blessed. I like how Eugene Peterson puts it in The Message. He says this: "You're blessed when you've lost it all. God's kingdom is there for the finding. You're blessed when you're ravenously hungry. Then you are ready for the messianic meal. You're blessed when the tears flow freely. Joy comes in the morning." From the very first line of this speech, Jesus shocked everyone, and he knew it. It was like he wanted them to be stunned, wanted them to really listen. I think he really wanted those who were marginalized or felt like they were marginalized to realize that they were valuable, that they had found themselves in God's story as well. And so he uses this word, blessed, truly blessed. This word blessed has also been translated to happy and fortunate. Some Bible scholars translate the word blessed to lucky. Someone else pointed out that when God calls a person blessed, God is actually saying, "I am on your side, both now and in the future." It's like there's some divine favor for them and on them. That Jesus is saying the very people who were marginalized by the world, who have nothing and come empty, they are the ones who are lifted up, who are seen, who are loved, who are filled. They get the time and the attention. And just to be clear here, Jesus is not solely glorifying suffering for its own sake. He isn't saying poverty is good or starving ourselves is the better life choice. What he is addressing and exposing is our misplaced security on it. When we are comfortable, when we stop depending on God, but those who are hungry, desperate, and empty are the ones who are the most open to his presence. They are the most open to what he has to offer. True blessing isn't about these external circumstances. It's about who we trust and where we place our hope. He's calling us to truly actually depend on him in everything. Because when we are empty and when we have nothing left to give, we are ready to receive. When we are full, I don't think there is a lot of room for God to even be. The famous author C.S. Lewis said this. He said, "He who has God and everything else has no more than he who has God only." At the end of the day, everything doesn't matter. All the wealth, success, fame, all the possessions we might own, it doesn't matter. But it is God that calls us to something. God that fills our hearts and our souls. I mean, let's just take a moment and see if you can think of someone in your life that you might know who have been diagnosed with cancer or some life-defining illness or has gone through some trauma or hardship that they wouldn't have chosen for themselves. This may have been yourself in your own story. When you look back at them and remember their words, at least in my experience, it's often been described as this wake-up call, where they've come to realize what's truly the most important thing in their life. That all they strived for in the world, it just didn't matter anymore. And so when Jesus says, blessed are you who are poor, blessed are you when you've lost it all, God's kingdom is there for the finding. He's not making this blanket statement saying material poverty is a gift in and of itself. Nor is he saying that every person who is materially poor discovers this great treasure of God's kingdom or God's presence in their lives. I mean, you can be relatively poor and still hold on to all of the world's allure to wealth or whatever it is that you long for. But Jesus is pointing out that when we've experienced poverty or some kind of loss, some kind of adversity, there's something about that that can make us more open to recognizing the essential poverty of our own human condition, and then therefore become more receptive to the grace of God. Billy Graham's grandson, Tullian, a number of years ago went through a very difficult experience of personal turmoil, and after wrestling with his faith in Jesus, made this discovery. It's these words, Jesus plus nothing equals everything. I think what Tullian is trying to say is that if you have Jesus, you have the most essential thing in your life. That nothing in this world can add to everything that Jesus offers. I think we all feel, at least at times, that we're empty, that we have nothing, that we're less than. Possibly because we're subconsciously seeing the rest of the world and all the excess that exists. Parts of us may reject it and parts of us may long for it. But really, what that is naming is the fact that we're all feeling empty. That we're lacking in some way. And instead of filling it with worldly things, what if we were dependent on Christ himself in those moments, allowing Christ to fill us and everything we need in it? Which I think begs this question. Where do we feel empty in our life? And with that, how can we let God fill us? But what if the opposite is also true? What if fullness, the kind the world promises, can actually leave us starving? We chase security, success, and satisfaction, believing that having more will finally make us feel whole. But Jesus challenges this assumption. He doesn't just bless those who are empty. He warns those who are full, because not all fullness leads to life, and not all emptiness leads to loss. I mean, we live in a world where being full is the goal. We want full bank accounts, full schedules, full plates, full approval of others. And yet, for all this fullness, so many of us still feel hollow inside. Jesus issues this sobering warning. Sometimes having everything we think we need can blind us to what we truly need the most. And so we read it in the Message version in these verses. But it's trouble ahead if you think you have it made. What you have is all you'll ever get. And it's trouble ahead if you're satisfied with yourself. Yourself will not satisfy you for long. And it's trouble ahead if you think life's all fun and games. There's suffering to be met, and you're going to meet it. These woes and warnings kind of feel like a little crushing, okay? It's like a blow after blow, a punch after a punch, knocking down anyone who feels like they might even just sit a little bit higher than others. It's like Jesus is saying, if you live with this operating system that values wealth and power and comfort, if you live for the approval of others, for being constantly acknowledged, whether it's through your achievements or by seeking approval through likes and followers on Instagram and social media, woe to you. There's trouble ahead. But Jesus isn't condemning wealth or joy here. I think he's actually exposing their limits. If we build our lives on comfort, on self-sufficiency, on our ability to control our circumstances, we may have everything we've ever wanted, but we'll still be missing the one thing we need. The danger of worldly success is that it feels fulfilling until it isn't. This is what psychologists call the hedonic treadmill. So let's do a little exercise. Imagine, you can close your eyes if you want, but imagine you're on a treadmill. You can increase the speed all you want, and every time you're still on the treadmill, essentially in the same place. This is the basic idea of the hedonic treadmill. The idea that no matter how much we gain, we'll always adapt and start wanting more. More success, more approval, more money. The ever-declining levels of satisfaction we feel, even though we work harder and harder, accumulating all of the riches, all the relationships, all the things your heart may desire. But what if that treadmill never stops? What if we're always running but never arriving? Running and running. And running, almost like a hamster in a wheel. That sounds so exhausting to me. While presenting an award at the 2016 Golden Globes, two-time Golden Globe winner Jim Carrey gets up to the front and presents and jokes about how he goes to bed every night as a two-time Golden Globe winner, dreaming of being a three-time Golden Globe winner named Jim Carrey. And he and this whole room of actors are all chuckling with him as he then continues to say these words, because then I would be enough. I would finally be true. And I could stop this terrible search for what I know ultimately won't fulfill me. In the past, Jim Carrey's made a lot of comments, and he said things like this: I think everybody should get rich and famous and do everything they ever dreamed of so they can see that it's not the answer. But that's just it, right? We live in this culture that celebrates abundance, that a good life is often measured by what we have, what we've achieved, and how comfortable we are. I think, like Jim Carrey and most of the world, we chase after this superficial sense of success, that it might bring true fulfillment, hoping that it might bring true fulfillment, that it might be our truest self. It'll offer true pride or security, that it will make us feel full. But the unfortunate reality is that no matter what we are chasing, we aren't full ever. We aren't satisfied, and we're left more empty and more crushed in the wake. And that's why I think Jesus is actually offering these warnings to us, hoping we realize the fullness we may be seeking is in fact deceptive. What if the things we think satisfy us are actually keeping us from what we need the most? What if being full in this world actually starves us spiritually? Here's a little visual exercise again for us. Let's say you are all starving right now. Like you haven't had dinner, maybe lunch, maybe breakfast. You haven't eaten in a while, no matter what. And the first thing you start craving is a bag of chips. This is often my first craving. In fact, there are probably, let's say, 4 bags of chips in front of you. And you open that first bag and you start eating it. And at first, your body is going to feel full. Maybe there's this sense of satisfaction. You think, I could easily eat more, so maybe I'm going to open up another bag. So you open it up, and you keep munching. You're starting to feel a little bit ill, but think, no, I'm still hungry. I can get another bag. So bag number 3, you open up. This is just easy. It's just right, isn't it? It's here. So you keep eating it. And then you open another bag and you eat. And then it hits you. You begin to feel gross inside. Your body is reacting, sometimes not in a great way. You might feel a little sick. You've passed from this full stage into this overloaded stage. And then you just feel awful for probably the rest of the day, if not a couple of days after. I think Jesus knows what we're going to want to explore, Jesus knows that we are going to want to explore the things that are right there in front of us. That we think those things will fill us up. So instead of chasing our various pathways of blessings, of things that we think fill us, Jesus offers us this other way. An escape off that hamster wheel, or giving us a nutrient-rich meal so that we no longer live in this misery of always clawing for more of the wrong things. So we'll truly be satisfied and full by Him. In our world, we can be so satisfied with these temporary things that we never actually hunger for eternal things. It's those worldly things that actually enslave us, that overwhelm us, that can sometimes offer more anxieties and stressors than we think possible, all the while giving ourselves this illusion of being full and satisfied and joyful. But Jesus' warning isn't about what's in our bank accounts, but what's in our hearts. Which makes me feel like we need to ask these questions of, where do you need to be emptied? And yet again, how can you let God fill you? So, where does this leave us? Jesus presents us with 2 paths. This empty yet full, or this full yet empty. And the world tells us that fullness comes from more money, more success, more control, more approvals. But Jesus says true fullness is found in being empty enough to receive Him. The reality is we are all hungry for something. We all chase after things we believe will satisfy us, only to find ourselves still searching, still restless, still unfulfilled. And maybe today, as we hear these words of Jesus, we begin to recognize our own hunger and our own emptiness. The places where we've tried to fill ourselves with things that don't last. Where we've been chasing after a kind of blessing that is more illusion than reality itself. And yet, Jesus doesn't expose the emptiness of our pursuits. He offers us himself. In John 6:35, he declares this, "I am the bread of life. Whoever comes to me will never go hungry. And whoever believes in me will never be thirsty." This is the upside down invitation, the one of the kingdom of God, to lose everything so we might gain everything in him, to let go of our false fullness so we might receive true fulfillment, to surrender the temporary so we might hold on to the eternal. Let's pray. So Lord, maybe it's time for us to step off the treadmill. Maybe it's time we lay down the pursuit of things that will never satisfy. Maybe it's time to bring our hunger to you, the only one who truly fills. Because in your kingdom, we know that those who are empty will be full. And those who are full of the world will find themselves starving. So may we be the ones who hunger for the right things. May we be the ones who find our true blessing, not in what we have, but in who we have. Amen.